طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Another full program today, so let's get started. We were fortunate to be present and record for This Week in Palestine, a forum held by a collaboration of Harvard student Palestinian support organizations to recognize Nakba Week. The forum featured Dr. Cornel West, philosophy professor at Harvard University, Rhonda Wabi of the Adamir Prison Support and Human Rights Association, Carl Williams, staff attorney at the ACLU of Massachusetts, and the forum was moderated by educator, organizer, and activist Jamila Hussein Shannon. The title of the forum, Black Palestinian Solidarity and Shared Struggle for Solidarity.
Good evening, everybody. This is one of those dreams come true. I'm sitting here with three amazing people with whom I've done a lot of work and organizing. So I have like an official bio, but you can Google it. I'm going to tell you who they are from my personal experience. I'm going to start with... So Dr. Cornel West, everybody knows who he is. More than 20 years ago, I was here at Harvard getting a PhD or a doctorate degree, and I used to work with a professor, Aileen de los Reyes, and she used to teach a course called Education for Social and Political Change. It was elective. Nobody had to take it. It wasn't a requirement for anybody to graduate. We had 120 students every semester.
Wow. That's right.
And Dr. West used to come visit our class every single semester. And it was the highlight of the class. And we would finish the semester still discussing the thoughts and ideas and the analysis that Dr. West provided. Then years later, we end up meeting again in Ferguson. And I'm driving around, not knowing the city. And I'm supposed to come down, but it was not easy. And watching Dr. West arrive in Ferguson and the impact it had on the streets, on the young organizers, what it meant for everybody who was there, that you showed up and stood with us and went to every event, every demonstration in the streets. This is, for me, this is the organic intellectual that Gramsci talks about. This is the person who survives and teaches at ivory tower institutions like this one in Princeton and more, teaches them what they hopefully will learn, and also is the same person who shows up in the streets at night in areas and moments when ivory tower people don't want to be associated. So this is Cornel West. Rhonda Wahbi, like many other Palestinians, arrives at the U.S. She's a doctoral student in anthropology and quickly understands the connection, quickly sees why we as Palestinians need to join our struggle with the Black Liberation Movement. Rhonda's experience in Palestine includes working for Ad-Damir. Ad-Damir is an organization that focuses on Palestinian political prisoners. As Palestinians, for us, all our prisoners are political prisoners. And I would say the same about the U.S. All prisoners are political prisoners. So Randa brings that experience with her and understanding how incarceration works and how communities can organize to support our loved ones on the other end of the fence. So please welcome Randa Wahbi with me. This is Carl Williams. Many of you probably already know him. Carl and I have done a lot of things together. We laugh and we joke and we get stuff done, or like Carl would like to say, we get shit done. For me, one of the most impressive moments with Carl was 2 years ago when we drove to Maine with a bunch of other lawyers to support a group of young women, mostly black and Muslim women, who had been harassed and absolutely treated horribly by the police. And I was sitting there, I probably was one of two who were not lawyers in that van. And to hear Carl discuss all the details with other lawyers, you wouldn't even realize that he's coaching them. But that's what it was. It was mentoring, it was coaching. And you see the radical thought of Carl comes through when he talks about the role of the lawyer. Because he can say all the talk, but then the actually bringing us together, driving to Maine and pushing the case and helping not only the people who were impacted, but also I was put in charge to talk to the allies, mostly white people, to help them figure out how they could be allies for the women. It was a full, thorough program that Carl put together in a second, because enough of us know and trust Carl. He says show up, I show up not knowing what for. I just know it's good. So this is Carl Williams. So our first speaker tonight is going to be Randa. She's going to set some sort of frame to help us dig deeper into the Black Palestinian solidarity discussion that we're about to have.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the kind introduction, Jamila, and thank you to the Committee for Justice in Palestine and the Black Students Association for this invitation. Israeli Apartheid Week comes at a critical time this year, just weeks before the 70th commemoration of the Nakba and during a series of protests in Gaza for the right of return. And I prepared a few words because sometimes I do find it really hard to talk about some of the issues I'm about to step into. And I want to start off by talking about a young man from Jerusalem named Fadi Alnon, whose story illustrates to me what life is like for young Palestinians. Fadi was a 19-year-old Palestinian from Jerusalem. He was on his way to work the night shift at a bakery on a cold October evening so he could save money to buy a car. He had just gotten his license, finally. His family said he loved singing, that his voice was like a bird, he was athletic and loved telling jokes and full of excitement about life. That night, Fadi was targeted by a mob of Israeli settlers and started running away as they were yelling slurs like, "Kill the Arabs," and inciting the police to shoot him, claiming he had a knife. While he was running from the mob, two police vehicles showed up and immediately gunned him down. Rather than check his pulse or check if he was possibly still alive, they flipped over his body with their combat boots to make sure he was dead. No ambulance or doctor was allowed near the body. Fadi's ordeal was not to end there. His mourning father and uncle were immediately arrested and interrogated. His body was not given back to his family for 6 days, delaying the funeral and denying the family an autopsy, or basically any forensic evidence in order to appeal to the court. No investigation was opened. This year, 54 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli police or military, the majority of them in a massacre in Gaza during the March of Return. 60 black people have been killed this year in the United States. The most recent is Saeed Vasil, whose new neighbors in gentrified Crown Heights in Brooklyn called the police on him, assuming he was violent. And Stephen Clark, 22 years old, who was shot down with 20 rounds of ammo, 6 rounds of which were in his back, because police believed he pointed a gun at them when he only had a cell phone. And this reminds me of the case of 25-year-old Mustafa Nimer, who was shot by Israeli soldiers in his car while driving home with his cousin Ali from the mall. The Israeli army blamed Ali for driving erratically and arrested him and charged him with manslaughter. It was only after CCTV footage was released that the police admit any wrongdoing. The investigation of the officers was closed due to lack of evidence. Alton Sterling's case was closed because the cops were found to be justified in their use of force, despite video footage showing Alton pinned to the ground by the officers before he was fatally shot. In an interview, Alton Sterling's aunt said, "They're not going to bring charges on anybody. Why would they do that? This is white America." This resonates with me. Over 1,000 complaints of torture of Palestinian prisoners and detainees have been filed since 2001, and not a single criminal case has been opened. Palestinians in the West Bank live under Israeli military law, where they are governed by over 1,600 military orders that control every aspect of life. When they are arrested, and over 6,500 Palestinians are currently in Israeli jails, and over 800,000 have been arrested at some point, they are charged in Israeli military courts. 99.7% of those in the military courts are found guilty. The only time you see a number that high in the courts are when police officers in the United States are on trial for killing people and found innocent. Palestinians completely understand what it's like to be guilty until proven innocent. There are hundreds of cases of Palestinians that mirror cases of police brutality in the United States. While the history of our racialization is not the same, the mechanisms and apparatuses that are killing Palestinians are the same as the ones in the U.S. We know and feel and understand deeply what it means to have a target on our back at all times, to be under surveillance at all times, to be attacked and then blamed for protesting these injustices. I opened today with the horrific stories of these brutal violences, but I want to take a step back to think about the daily surveillance we live under that is done under the guise of peacekeeping or protecting our safety. And I want to think a little bit about technology and militarization. I was in Palestine a few weeks ago with a delegation of graduate students, and we came across tear gas canisters in Aida refugee camp that were made by a company called Combined Tactical Systems. This is a company in Jamestown, Pennsylvania, that designs and develops less lethal and innovative ammunitions and weapons for crowd control. This is the same company that supplied police in Ferguson with tear gas. And that is not all that is shared between Israel and the United States. The St. Louis police were trained by the Israeli police and military on counterterrorism strategies that were used against protesters in Ferguson as forms of crowd control. Protests being met with violence is not new, but the exchange of police forces, tactics, and using the same weapons is an act of solidarity between two oppressive political systems. Months before Obama left office, he pledged $38 billion to Israel, the highest amount that had ever been pledged at one time, most of which is for military aid. Anti-terrorism and technologies that are quote-unquote not lethal, but are militarized and violent are supposed to control us. And there are other technologies that work in the same way. For example, we are all familiar with the stop and frisk programs in the United States that target black people of color, poor people, and people of color. These programs have turned into stop and spit, where people are stopped and coerced to provide DNA samples in order to be let go. Guilty before proven innocent. Where do all these DNA samples go? They go into a data bank, heavily skewed with samples of black and brown men who are stopped for no reason. And it's from these data banks that suspects to crimes are first evaluated under scientific methods that are not foolproof. We know that black men are overrepresented in these systems used around the country and make up at least 40% of the database. Why are all of these samples, biometrics, being taken and registered if not to monitor and surveil and subject populations? Similarly, Palestinians face the same biometric surveillance. Walking around in Jerusalem, you see cameras, police pens, soldiers walking around everywhere. As a Palestinian, you must carry your identification card at all times, which can be entered into a computer and reveal every checkpoint you have ever crossed, every time you've left the country, who your family members, who your friends are, what school you go to, where you live, where you have lived, and so on and so on. We are calculated, tabulated, monitored, surveilled for every move that we make. We are targeted and then bound to bureaucratic systems that are built against us. Khalif Browder, 16 years old, was accused of theft, arrested, and sent to Rikers Island for 3 years, put under solitary confinement, where he was never convicted of a crime and released without any help re-entering the school system, re-entering the world after such a traumatic experience. He ultimately took his own life. When I think about Khalif Browder, I think about Ahed Tamimi, 17 years old, who was just sentenced to 8 months in prison for slapping a soldier who was on her property. Today, 427 Palestinians are in Israeli jails without charge and denied trial, one of them being my colleague Salah Hamouri, a human rights activist who's been under administrative detention since September, and Khalida Jarrad, a Palestinian Legislative Council member who has been held since last July. We live under a chokehold in Palestine, where every move is monitored, every act of resistance is punished, and the occupation continues to entrench itself. Our very acts of protest are threats to the Israeli state and met with violence, just as Black Lives Matter protests are met with the National Guard. This week, a woman at a protest for Stephen Clark was run over by a Sacramento sheriff's vehicle. The message is clear for both of us: stay silent or face violent consequences. I want to end by saying a few words about Gaza in light of the ongoing March of Return protests that are happening, because despite everything they go through, they keep hope for us alive. Since March 30th, Palestinians in Gaza, of which 1.2 million are refugees, have been holding protests, sit-ins, dabka parties, cookouts, etc. on the border, demanding that they be able to return to their original lands and homes taken away from them in 1948. On March 30th, 30,000 people came out to protest, and they were met with army planes spraying them with tear gas and snipers shooting at them. 16 Palestinians were killed that day. Gaza is in mourning, not just for those losses, but for the 11-year blockade that has completely isolated Gaza and made it into an open-air prison, and also for the continuous wars waged on Gaza. In 2009, when white phosphorus was used on the Palestinians, in 2012, and in 2014, when thousands of Palestinians were killed, a fourth of them children. The people in Gaza are rising up despite the repeated disappointments from the international community, who have failed them time and time again. The youth in Gaza are marching not just because they don't have any other options, but because they want to imagine their own future. This is what self-determination is: the ability to rise up from the ashes time and time again and demand our liberation on our own terms. We are all complicit in the destruction of Gaza. Our tax dollars go to develop new weapons that are used on Gaza, weapons that are tweaked slightly after people are murdered to make them quote-unquote less lethal and packaged for other parts of the world. On the eve of April 8th, before the second March of Return commenced, during which Palestinian journalist Yasser Murtaza and 8 other Palestinians were killed, one of the organizers wrote a piece about why we protest, and I want to give my last words to him. And he said, "Over the past 8 days, tens of thousands of protesters in Gaza have breathed life into a place that is slowly being depleted of it. We have come together, chanting and singing a lullaby we all longed for. We will return, bringing all that we have left to offer in an attempt to reclaim our right to live in freedom and justice. Resisting the fate that Israel has planned for us, we are fighting back peacefully with our bodies and our love for life, appealing to the justice that remains in the world." Thank you.
I want to say I am blessed to be here. I've come to learn and listen. I want to salute my dear brother Christian, brother Hassan, for their leadership. So very important to have courage, vision, integrity, keeping track of a precious slice of humanity, often rendered invisible in public discourses, classrooms at Harvard and other places. To sit here on this panel with my dear sister Rhonda, this rich and moving and poignant presentation. My dear sister Dr. Yamila, who was a veteran freedom fighter, it's always a blessing. And Brother Esquire Carl, what can we say? Freedom fighter, I'm so glad each and every one of you are here, because we're here really for the dialogue. I'd like to dedicate my very brief remarks to my dear friend Edward Zayed. Met in 1977. Spent hours and hours and hours in his house, in the classroom, marching in front of the New York Times. They would use the word occupation in 1982 with the vicious invasion of Lebanon. He, along with Noam Chomsky, are the two towering public intellectuals in the midst of a U.S. empire undergoing relative decline and undeniable decay. We should never forget the witness of Edward Zayed. You know his text, The Question of Palestine, and a whole host of other texts. He gave so much of his life as an ivory tower intellectual. He was a highbrow humanist, trained here, PhD at Harvard, Princeton undergraduate, taught at Columbia for over 40 years. I'm here tonight because I jump at the opportunity to show publicly my very deep solidarity with my precious Palestinian brothers and sisters. Whatever the context, whatever the circumstances, because I come from a black freedom struggle, a tradition of a hated people who have taught the world so much about how to love. Love of truth, the condition of truth is always to allow suffering to speak. It could be peasants in Mexico. It could be Dalits in India. It could be Roma in Europe. It could be trans folk. It could be Jews in France or Russia. It's a profoundly human thing that any time you see oppression, domination, raise your voice. Be part of the focus in that regard. Amen. And I concluded a long time ago that the Israeli occupation is not just illegal and immoral, but it's evil. And like apartheid, it's a crime against humanity. And it needs to be said clearly, and it's very difficult in the U.S. empire to speak unflinchingly about the night side of those realities without being viewed as anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish or somehow hating our precious Jewish brothers and sisters. And of course, I always respond, I would be the same meeting if there were a Palestinian occupation of precious Jewish brothers and sisters. Because it's wrong, it's immoral, it's illegal, it's evil. Rabbi Heschel used to say, indifference to evil is more insidious than evil itself. William James, Harvard's own, used to say, indifference is the one trait that makes the very angels weep. And for too long, there's been a massive indifference to the suffering of priceless Palestinian brothers and sisters, including Palestinian babies. I don't know of any other people that could have over 550 babies killed in 51 days, and so few have the courage to raise their voices and say, this is barbaric. Why is that so? Well, because so many intellectuals, leaders, fellow citizens, they're just scared, they're afraid, they're intimidated. They don't want to speak the truth and allow the suffering to be heard. And that's the taboo that has to be shattered. And has to be shattered in such a way that, based on my own tradition, unarmed truth, unapologetic love, love of neighbor, but also love of truth, love of goodness, and love of beauty. Now, I'm also a Christian, so I know your first name is Christian. I'm in solidarity with that name. revolutionary Christian, which means that I'm fundamentally committed to a love of everybody. But I don't lose track of structures of domination and forms of oppression. Imperial. I come from a people. Been enslaved under slave-holding capitalist civilization. Who's been terrorized and traumatized under Jim Crow capitalist civilization. And we now live on the new Jim Crow capitalist civilization. And so the overlap that takes place between precious black brothers and sisters and precious Palestinian brothers and sisters, for me, begins with a moral and spiritual connection. There has to be a consistency. You see, we can't talk about being concerned about one group of oppressed folk and not saying a mumbling word about other oppressed people. We have to be morally constant and consistent across the board. That's what I like about Brother Frederick Douglass. That's what I like about Ida B. Wells Barnett. Even Marcus Garvey, the black nationalist tradition. I'm not a black nationalist, but I love my black nationalist brothers and sisters. It just strikes me a little bit too patriarchal and homophobic and transphobic, but that's all right. That's all right. But even Garvey in the African Liberation flag had a green, and the green stood for not just land, but the Irish brothers and sisters. Because he was anti-imperialist against the British Empire that held not just Jamaica, but also Ireland for 800 years. What is happening today is a new day. The taboo is being lifted. The ugliness, the viciousness of the treatment of our Palestinian brothers and sisters under Israeli occupation is more and more undeniable. You cannot ignore it. And it's a beautiful breakthrough. When you see the breakthrough among our precious young Jewish brothers and sisters, breaking from their parents, breaking from their grandparents. We have been told a lie. We were told there was land but no people. That's the myth of origins of every settler colonial enterprise. When they got to America, no people, just land. And buffaloes and Indians. No, those precious Indians are human beings. And if you're into buffalo rights, we can go there too. Let's tell the truth about the Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948. Let's keep track of the suffering. And of course, Jewish suffering is just as precious as any other suffering. But when you jump from the burning buildings of Europe after hundreds and hundreds of years of being trashed, persecuted, pogroms coming your way, dishonored, devalued, and you land on the backs of folk who are already there, you have a choice of coexisting. The way Albert Einstein and Judah Magnus and Ahakaham called for, or domination, the way Jabotinsky called for. It's no accident that Netanyahu comes out of the tradition of Jabotinsky, which is not just right-wing xenophobia, but is tied to a settler colonial mentality of an ethnic cleansing. And that's 750,000 precious Arabs in 1948 who were pushed out. Let's be honest about the story, and let's acknowledge the ways in which that story informs what is going on today. And right now we're seeing a global awakening around what is happening to our precious Palestinian brothers and sisters. And it is a marvelous new militancy. And I can rest assure you that if Brother Martin Luther King Jr. were around — this is fascinating because Martin Luther King Jr. considered himself a Zionist in the 1960s. He believed in Jewish self-determination. But if he were able to learn now the full story of 1948, if he were able to see the consequences and the effects of the vicious Israeli occupation beginning in 1967, in the name of morality and spirituality, he would raise his voice and say, let us make sure that that we cast a major spotlight and be in solidarity and support various efforts, nonviolent efforts, to break the back of an evil and a crime against humanity called the Israeli occupation, and let us have a serious public conversation about how in that very difficult and delicate area and the dynamics between Israelis and Palestinians that we reach some way of moving toward justice. And it's a complicated situation. I don't know of anybody who has the answer, but I know one thing, that for too long Palestinians have had to bear the brunt. And that is coming to an end. And thank God we've got people here at Harvard and other places who are willing to become part of that discourse, of that practice, and most importantly ensuring that any form of xenophobia and homophobia and transphobia is radically called into question, even as we keep track of imperial policies of which the U.S. government is most guilty. And I don't care who your favorite president is. Pick out any of them from 1940, no matter what color, they all have been complicitous in terms of the mistreatment, the dishonoring, and devaluing of the Palestinian people.
That was amazing. Thank you. Can I get some sympathy here that I'm going after?
That's right.
But now I'm going to say the second thing I'm going to say. I'm going to respectfully disagree, in agreement with what Dr. Cornell said.
I got a lot to learn, my brother.
You said no. I'm going to add on to the piece and see if you agree with me. Hopefully, you do.
Yeah.
You said it's incredibly difficult to stand up for Palestinian rights and incredibly difficult to stand up for Black rights too. But I think in another way, it's incredibly difficult not to.
That's
like,
true.
In ways, it's much harder because you have to do something horrible to your eyes, and you have to do something terrible to your heart, and you have to do something wicked to your brain to see these things every day for decades and not believe and not understand that both of these struggles, I'll say the one struggle, is to not do that.
Right.
That
right.
does something incredibly deep to your soul.
That's
so
that's
if you're
true.
Not doing that right now, you hear, you're
that's
seeing
true.
It somewhere. The real story, I was going to say, another brother of ours said, there can never really be justice on stolen land. And that's KRS-One for folks who aren't into old school hip hop. And here in the United States of America, in the Middle East, on Palestinian land, that is factual, that is true. That needs to be where we go back to start our search for justice. And I always, sorry, I carry this around with me because I'm a nerd. So this is the copy of the United States Constitution. And I think terminology is incredibly important, so I'm going to call it the first war, the first American war to defend slavery in 1776. Because many people supported that war, right? The South supported that war because they said, well, you know, those in Britain, they're starting to abolish slavery over there, so we would like that not to happen here. So we'll sign up for your war against them. I heard someone recently say that the United States Constitution is the most perfect document that was ever written. And so I saw that inspired me. Some people probably have heard me say this. I went to the Constitution and I counted, right? Well, you can go online and find the number of words in the Constitution. It's about 2,800 in the main body of the Constitution, or about 3,000. Of those words, that's without the Bill of Rights, so amended Constitution is about 3,000 words. Of that, about 280, 290 are words explicitly devaluing Native people and Black people, or words explicitly, or implicitly allowing for the ownership and the protection of the laws that allow for ownership, and the enslavement of Black people. I think that's a crucial piece of understanding where the United States is today, right? So we wrote they wrote. They wrote a document to that arguably the most important part of it is enslaving human beings. Right? More important than the structure of the presidency. More important, you know, the people might know this, the Constitution doesn't say how many people should be on the Supreme Court. They could have like spent two more words on that, but they didn't. They wanted to get to other things, saying you can that African Americans count for 3/5 of a human being, and that's not in terms of rights, that's in terms of representation to actually give more power to the southern states. And in that same sentence, it says how much native life was represented, what proportional government should be allotted to a native life. People know how much that is?
Zero.
Zero. You know what it still is?
Zero.
It still is zero. Right? There's some sovereignty reasons for that. We won't go into it, but go back. It's an easy place to find. It's Article 1, Section 2, Paragraph 3. It talks about that. And there are parts of the Constitution that were unamendable. There are parts of the Constitution that you could not amend, even if you went through the entire amendment process. There were a number of years. They said, we're going to set a number of years that you cannot change this part of the Constitution. Was that about the presidency? Was that about not having kings? Was that about the shape of the Senate or the House of Representatives or what the judiciary looked like? No. It was about protecting the parts of the Constitution that allowed for enslavement of black people in this country. So if you're going to say, like, I'm going to write a document and you can edit all of it, but you can't edit this part, it'd make you kind of believe that somebody thought that was the most important part, right? And they don't teach that in constitutional law. Because you need to keep that, that's what we're talking about, you need to keep that, your heart and your mind away from the facts of that, right?
Yeah.
So someone go over there and write that on the wall. So I think at that time, in the documents, in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, the Declaration of Independence talks about the merciless Indian savages whose only known rule of existence is extermination of all ages, sexes, and classes. It calls people terrorists, right? It's really one word away from calling people terrorists, talking about native folks. And that was the complaint to the King of England, saying, like, look at these terrible things he does. He sicks these terrorists on us, and we have to be able to fight back, and he doesn't allow us to do that. Pointing terrorists, causing blame, saying we need to fight against that. Is that happening anywhere else? Okay. So I really think with the Declaration of Independence, with what the structure of the Constitution and the structure of in the formation of this country, there was an invention that happened. And it's, I would argue, the most deadly invention that the world has ever seen. And that is the invention of whiteness. Right? That has allowed people to invade countries. That has allowed people to, at a push of a button, to kill hundreds of thousands of people in a second. That is something that was created in the United States of America. It was created in some ways, you could argue, at the creation of the United States of America. The concept didn't really exist before that, right? And so a lot of people are very proud of American things. It's like one of the most impactful things that the United States of America has ever created is whiteness. And that has allowed for the occupation, a lot of times people talk about the genocide of Native American people. Native American people were not one people here. We're not Sioux and Arapaho and Comanche and Lakota did not consider themselves one people. So there's multiple genocides and some that were entire. There are some linguistic groups that simply don't exist anymore. Right? And I think, so I always refer to that as multiple genocides across the continents. And that creation allows for a lot of things. It allows for, what the United States did at the end of World War II to Japan. It allowed for the nuclear bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It allowed for the firebombing of Tokyo. It allowed, many decades later, it allowed for what the United States did in El Salvador, in Guatemala, in Chile. It allowed for what the United States has historically done to, Haiti and the Dominican Republic. It's allowed, before that, what the United States did to the Philippines. And it's also allowed, by proxy, what the United States does to the Palestinian people. And that is not a separate thing, right? It's interesting, because I think the way we think about what the United States did in El Salvador, if we think about that, we think of what the United States is doing to Palestinians as somehow different because we put Israel there. But Israel would not and could not be doing the things it is doing to Palestinian people without the signature on the check by the United States of America. It could not do these things. And because the United States wants them done. And sometimes we think, oh, well, there's a powerful lobby and people want this. It's like, this is a proxy state. The United States wants these things done and it pays for them to be done and it is glad they're done. That is the structure of the United States government. It wants them done. I think that in the second part of that, the powerful lobby here and what Zionists push the United States Congress to do is that's value added for the United States. They're like, great, we're going to have an agreement and a symbiotic agreement. That's wonderful, and that causes all that hatred and causes all that destruction. But to talk about the positive pieces, I think one of the places that we can look, and Professor said this, is the history of black folks, particularly black women, in this country. I said from the second that black women arrived in this country, and black men also, but it's before that. Before the first black person ever even got to the shore of what became the United States of America, we were plotting, and we were scheming, and we were planning, and we were fighting for one thing, and that's for freedom.
That's right.
And separate out a little bit. For the black folks who are here, whether your family came from Nigeria last week, or whether your descendants are Caribbean, or whether you're more traditional African Americans who have migrated up from the South, or maybe you're still from the South and you just came up to go to this place, our struggle is very, very similar, right? And if you came here as an immigrant, your struggle is real, right, as a black person in this country. And if you came here, if your ancestors came here and you're a descendant of enslaved people, that struggle is real, and it's very similar in many ways. But one thing that we all have in common is that our great-great-great-grandmothers ran and fought like hell for freedom. And when they were doing that, they were thinking of what they were thinking, like, someday my great-great-grandchildren will go to Harvard, or someday my great-great-grandchildren will be a professor, or have a nice car, a nice house. They were thinking one thing, that someday they'll be free, right? That's a bill that you gotta pay, right? That's a bill that we have to pay, because they wanted you to be free. And they made that, to many extents, they made that happen, right? And I think that's something that we have to pay back, right? For our progeny, for Palestinian people. And I would say secondarily, the identical story in slightly different ways can be told for the history of the Palestinian people. And both on the forefront, the leadership really showing the world like what freedom struggles look like. And I think that's a thing that we're also in our hearts and our minds, we're made to forget, right? Because I asked some people some time ago, I said, I could have done it with y'all, but I didn't want to trick you like that. I could have asked, if you think of black culture in the United States, think of things that are markers of black culture. And there's a lot of really positive, really good things, and maybe some bad things that our minds have been infected with that we would think about, right? We'd like to think of music, we think of jazz, we would think of dance, we would think of art, we think of the Black Panther, we think of comic books, we think of many, many things, right, in modern history and historically. But one of the things that I think is overarching over all of them is the struggle, is building a struggle for freedom, building a model of a struggle for freedom. There's no one in the world anywhere that is really struggling for freedom. And major part of that discussion is not the anti-slavery movements in the United States and the slavery rebellions and the civil rights movement here. Thank you. So I think... I don't want to say anymore because I want to get to folks' questions and have some discussion. But really, I think the examples that we give, the examples that black folks and particularly black women have given in the freedom struggle, and the fact that the defeat of chattel slavery in this country was one of the greatest struggles for freedom that the world has seen. And if our forebears won that battle, this one is not that hard, right? Palestinian people can be free. Black people can be free. I was just on a panel somewhere. We were on a panel, and we had a white brother who said, I don't think it'll ever happen in my lifetime. And some of us were here. Looked and was like, some of us need that to happen in our lifetime. So I was like, that's not okay. We're not with that part of the program, right? But that's can't live and think, well, I'm not going to be free. Maybe my great-grandchildren will be free, because an essential part of all of this is freedom. Another essential part of it is hope and belief. And we can be free, we will be free, and it's never going to happen if just Palestinian people are free. And it's never going to happen if just black people are free. Because really, we said it before when we talked before another talk, because it really is one struggle.
Unfortunately, that is all the time we have this morning. You've been listening to a forum recorded at Harvard University titled Black Palestinian Solidarity and Shared Struggle for Solidarity, featuring Cornel West, Rhonda Wabi, Carl Williams, and Jamila Hussein Shannon. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.